hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 62, The Donatist Schism, Part 2. We left off last time in early 313 with Constantine receiving a petition against Bishop Caecilian of Carthage. The emperor had ordered the immediate restitution of all church property and extended benefits and privileges to Caecilian and his clergy. However, the proconsul of Africa was soon met by a large throng of people, led by an embassy of bishops opposed to Caecilian. These rigorists were partisans of Major Rhinus, the reader who the Numidians had ordained in place of Caecilian. In time, their movement would become known as the Donatist Church, named after Major Rhinus's successor, Donatus. The Donatists were alarmed that the emperor had apparently already decided Caecilian was the lawful bishop of Carthage. Surely the imperial court was aware of what had transpired in Africa. The Donatists came to believe Osius of Cordova was behind the emperor's prejudicial decision. Osius was, after all, from Spain, yet he had been away in Gaul when he became attached to the imperial court. Had he done something which forced him to flee his home province? Was Osius a secret traditor? This seems extremely unlikely. Osius was himself a confessor of the Great Persecution. However, the rumor soon found receptive ears in Donatist circles. Despite this bad start, the Donatists nevertheless seemed confident that, once the issue was properly examined, the emperor and the church at large would see their side of things. Caecilian was invalidly ordained by the traditor Felix of Abthugni, and Major Rhinus was the true bishop of Carthage. It may come as a surprise to some listeners that the Donatists would make an appeal to the Roman emperor to help settle an internal church dispute. But of course, we know this wasn't the first time a group of Christians had done such a thing. Prior to the narrative break, we discussed the schism in Antioch during the late 3rd century, which resulted after the controversial bishop there, Paul of Samosata, was ordered deposed. However, Paul and his followers had the support of the secular authorities at the time, and so the rest of the church was unable to remove him from the building. After the emperor Aurelian reconquered Syria, the Christians made an appeal. Aurelian deferred the matter to the bishops of Italy, stating he would support whichever side in Antioch the Italian churches agreed with. Paul of Samosata and his followers were on the losing side of this, and so were forcibly removed by the Roman authorities from the church. Though it may seem strange to us, it's important to remember that Roman citizens, Christians and pagans alike, believed the Roman emperor had divine authority to uphold justice and act as an arbitrator in the disputes of his subjects. After all, the Apostle Paul had appealed to Caesar during his trial before the governor of Judea 3 centuries earlier. Christians were no different than their pagan neighbors in exercising their right as Roman citizens to receive justice from the emperor. The Donatist embassy presented the proconsul with a petition for the emperor and a sealed document listing the charges against Caecilian. The petition requested that the emperor have Gallic bishops judge the dispute between the two factions. The reason for bishops from Gaul was because, as the Donatists happily reminded Constantine, that part of the empire had been immune from the Great Persecution, due to the emperor's late father Constantius, the only one of the original Tetrarchs who did not persecute his Christian subjects. On April 15, 313, the proconsul forwarded the documents along with his report to the emperor, now up in Milan, explaining what had happened. Constantine took the issue of division within the church very seriously. Like all Roman emperors, Constantine believed the security of his person and empire depended on divine favor which was maintained by offering proper worship. The supreme deity, who had shown himself to the emperor in a cross of light and granted him victory over Maxentius, was now the emperor's protector. The Christian God must be worshipped by a unified Catholic Church, the only group which could offer him his rightful worship. For Constantine, God was holding him by the hand, keeping him ever victorious and triumphant, but on the condition that worship was duly given. A divided church meant God was not being properly worshipped, and soon he would withdraw his favor and protection. This was something that Constantine, like all emperors before him, needed to prevent from happening. Rome needed divine blessing to prosper and remain powerful. Though the emperor had adopted the Christian God, his way of thinking about religion remained fundamentally Roman through and through. This fact is vitally important for us to remember if we want to accurately understand Constantine's relationship with the early church. Whatever his initial attitude may have been towards the Donatists, the emperor nevertheless granted their request. However, the precise form of this grant was not exactly what the Donatists were expecting. The emperor wrote to Bishop Miltiades of Rome and another, otherwise unknown, Mark, possibly the Roman archdeacon and future bishop. The emperor summarized the matter and had the documents he received from the proconsul appended to the imperial letter. He informed Miltiades and Mark that they would be joined by 3 Gallic bishops to adjudicate the dispute. These were, of course, Reticius of Autun, Maternus of Cologne, and Marinus of Arles, all 3 of whom had been with Constantine since before the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. The litigants in the case would include Caecilian himself and 10 bishops supporting him, and 10 Donatist bishops with accusations against him, all of whom would sail to Rome. Constantine's decision to defer the Donatist matter to the Bishop of Rome requires some elucidation. By this point in time, Constantine had left the old capital and was concluding his conference with Licinius in Milan during the latter's marriage to Constantine's sister. However, the emperor still needed to maintain ties with his power base in the old capital, including the local church. Osius of Cordova and Miltiades were allies of one another, and Miltiades' position as Bishop of the Eternal City made him both Primate of Italy and the most senior ranking cleric in the Western Empire. He was, after all, the successor to the apostles Peter and Paul, whose martyrdom had occurred in his city. Osius likely also informed Constantine of how other Christians had turned to the Church of Rome when it came to internal disputes, as we've seen in prior episodes. It's also important to remember the precedent of Aurelian. Aurelian had looked to the bishops of Italy when he decided the case of Paul of Samosata. Originally, the hearing in Rome was meant to be a somewhat informal and small church council. However, Miltiades gathered some 15 other Italian bishops to the synod. Technically, this had not been one of the provisions of the emperor's letter, but the pope apparently felt confident he would not receive imperial sanction. The precedent of Aurelian surely factored into this. Constantine also would not have wished to isolate his Roman support, and was probably also advised by Osius to allow Miltiades to expand the council. Miltiades had his own motivations, however. Prior to becoming bishop, he had been a presbyter under the Traditor Pope Marcellinus, and as such, the Donatist charge against Caecilian could cast suspicion on him. By summoning these other bishops, Miltiades was also asserting his position as Primate of Italy, as well as effectively stacking the council with loyal clerics who he could count on when it came to making the final decision. The bishops of Rome had for some time now been quite protective of their assertions of primacy within the Episcopal College, and Miltiades was no different. The meeting finally commenced on September 30th, 313, in the Lateran Palace. By this time, Constantine was back in Gaul, and Licinius was in the east, exterminating the remnants of the regime of Maximinus Daya. Also by this point, Major Rhinus had died and been succeeded by the great charismatic leader, Donatus of Casae Nigrae, or Donatus Magnus, whom we introduced at the end of last episode. Caecilian and his 10 supporters appeared before the Council of Rome, as did the 10 accusers, led by Donatus himself. However, rather than an informal arbitration, Miltiades decided to deploy the formal rules of Roman judicial practice, which meant trial witnesses were required. Donatus was taken aback, but nevertheless promised to produce witnesses who would confirm the accusations against Caecilian. This he failed to do, however, either because he was unable to, or, as the Donatists later alleged, Miltiades excluded them from the council's remaining sessions. It was therefore no surprise that during the final session on October 2nd, the council vindicated Caecilian. Furthermore, the council condemned the accusers, especially Donatus, for rebaptizing. In Africa, it made sense to the Donatists that, since Caecilian possessed no grace, any sacraments he performed were invalid and needed to be redone. But the council in Rome once again exposed the gap between African ecclesiology and the rest of the wider church, a gap which had been there since Cyprian's day. The Donatists were outraged at what they saw as an improper synod which had been stacked against them by pious prelates. They had wanted the three Gallic bishops to lead the decision-making, not those from Italy tainted by the crimes of persecution. 70 Numidian bishops had condemned Caecilian in Carthage years earlier. Surely their numbers had more weight than Miltiades and his small band. Accusations of traditio against the Pope and the others began to fly, and the Council of Rome utterly failed to settle the dispute. So the Donatists again appealed to the emperor for a Gallic synod to judge between them and the Caecilianists. Constantine's response was apoplectic. A validly constituted council of bishops had convened and decided on the matter. That should have been the end of it. Yet the Donatists were still pestering him, and the schism had not been healed. Their division was threatening the worship of the highest god. However, it appears the Western Augustus mellowed as he eventually decided to grant their second request. It seems he was willing to concede the possibility that the Council of Rome may have been biased, and a larger gathering in Gaul was what was needed. At the very least, such a council would be hard for the Donatists to dismiss. Constantine therefore took the momentous step, momentous in retrospect at least, of personally summoning a church council. The first time a Roman emperor had ever done such a thing. The emperor ordered that the council meet by August 1st in the city of Arles under the presidency of Bishop Marinus, with the expressed agenda of settling the Donatist schism. The emperor himself would attend the meeting and observe its sessions. Often when you read histories of this period, Constantine's summoning of the Council of Arles is viewed as a crucial turning point in church-state relations, the moment when the secular lord unilaterally convoked a church council on his own authority. Many modern commentators, ambivalent about the merits of a Roman emperor taking such an initiative, have been equally shocked by the reaction of the early church. None of our sources betray any disquiet or protest from the Christians at the time. It seems that the bishops simply accepted the emperor's claim he could order them to meet in a council. However, again, we need to remember the historical context. Just as the Donatists showed no hesitation in appealing to the emperor, Christians at the time seem to have seen no issue with the emperor convoking a church council. Another important reminder that we need to be careful not to impose our modern notions of church-state relations on the ancient world. The following spring, Constantine issued a letter to the Vicar of Africa, who, interestingly enough, was also a Christian, ordering that Caecilian and his allies, as well as a group of Donatist accusers, be sent to Arles. The bishops were to travel by imperial post, and the vicar needed to make sure they arrived in the city in time for the council. Curiously, Constantine ordered that the Caecilianists take the longer overland route from Africa across Mauritania, then sail across the Straits of Gibraltar into Spain, and from there proceed north to Gaul. The Donatists, on the other hand, would sail directly from Africa to the port of Marseille. The reasoning for this is not clear, but one suggestion is that, given the level of tension between the two factions, the emperor was concerned about fisticuffs breaking out along the journey if the two parties traveled together. The Council of Arles formally commenced on time at the beginning of August 314. The synod was chaired by the local bishop Marinus, and bishops from all over the Western Empire were present. The exact total number of bishops varies in our sources, ranging from the mid-20s to the mid-40s. Also in attendance was the emperor himself, who sat in on the proceedings as a layman accompanied by no armed bodyguards, but instead simply Christian courtiers. If the Donatists thought they would win this time, though, they were sorely mistaken. The bishops at Arles found their behavior distasteful, especially the practice of rebaptism. The ecclesiological disconnect was quite apparent. Caecilian was reaffirmed to be the Catholic Bishop of Carthage. Donatus and his supporters were condemned. In addition to deciding the case of Caecilian, the Council of Arles also issued some 22 canons, a few of which are worth highlighting. The African practice of rebaptism was explicitly condemned, consecration by a traditor bishop was not deemed invalid, any accusations of traditio had to pass a certain standard of evidence before any bishop was deposed. A number of the other canons dealt with issues not related to the Donatist schism, such as excluding theater performers and charioteers from communion, and requiring Christian imperial magistrates to submit to episcopal discipline. Clergy were not to be translated to different regions, but to serve in the place where they had been ordained. The celebration of Easter was to be the same throughout all the churches of the world. The issue of regional variation for the date of the Paschal feast is something we will explore in more detail in a future episode. Perhaps the most interesting was Canon 3, which dealt with the excommunication of Christian soldiers. The traditional reading is that Christians in the Roman army were not to lay down their arms during the time of peace. Peace here has been interpreted as meaning peacetime generally, or perhaps referring specifically to the peace of the church. Now that the empire had an imperial convert and the persecutions were over, Christian soldiers would no longer be compelled to perform any duties which conflicted with their faith. This would make Canon 3 a rejoinder to the more rigorous Christians who believed military service was incompatible with their faith. An alternative translation, however, suggests the opposite, that Christians who brandish weapons during peacetime were instead to be excommunicated. The former reading is the one most scholars seem to prefer, but I thought I'd at least mention the alternative. The Council of Arles wrapped up by issuing a letter to Pope Sylvester, Miltiades having died back in January. The new Bishop of Rome had not attended the council itself, but had sent two presbyters and a deacon as representatives. The reason for Sylvester's failure to appear seems to be a combination of needing to consolidate his position in the face of local Donatist opposition, and his desire to maintain the primacy of the Roman See. The Roman popes did not travel to the cities of other bishops for councils. Instead, they only attended councils which were local and at which they presided. The Council of Arles does not seem to have been bothered by this, and accepted Sylvester's decision not to join his brother bishops in person. Expressing their longing to see him, but respecting his reasons for his absence, the synod issued a conciliar letter communicating their decisions and canons to the Pope. With everything now wrapped up, the council disbanded, and Constantine sent the bishops back to their home sees. As far as the emperor and most of the Western Church were concerned, the issue was over. The Caecilianists were regarded as Catholic, while the Donatists were in schism. Two church councils consisting of respectable bishops from various provinces had now issued the same judgment. But of course, the Donatists refused to accept these verdicts. They once again petitioned the emperor. Having realized no non-African council bishops would decide in their favor, the Donatists stated they wanted the emperor himself to judge the case. Constantine was furious. He ordered the Donatists in Gaul sent to his court, and furthermore commanded the vicar of Africa to also send any Donatists there to court. The schism was now a scandal in the emperor's mind, a scandal which opened Christians up to mockery and ridicule by the pagans. Two church councils, under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, had settled the matter. In his letter to the Council of Arles, congratulating the bishops for their decision, the emperor denounced the Donatists and their appeal for his own judgment. How could he, Constantine wrote, presume to judge the case when he himself awaited the judgment of Christ? Conciliar decisions made by the priests of God were holy and to be regarded as authoritative, as if God himself had sat in judgment. The emperor disparaged the Donatists as wicked men, abhorrent to God, full of madness, and agents of the devil. The Donatists may have anticipated their defeat at Arles and the emperor's reaction to a third appeal. Only 2 weeks after the council, one of their number presented incriminating evidence to the secular authorities in Carthage against Caecilian and Felix of Apthugni. Back during our coverage of the Great Persecution, you may recall that the local magistrate in Apthugni who enforced Diocletian's first edict was one Alpheus Caecilianus. This man, now well into old age, was approached by a certain Donatus decurion named Ingentius. Ingentius managed to procure from the former magistrate a letter to Felix which purported to prove that the bishop had indeed been a traditor by allowing the scriptures to be burned. On August 18, 314, this letter was presented by a Donatist elder to a local magistrate and priest of Jupiter in Carthage. Since Alpheus Caecilianus was too old to travel to the imperial court, the Donatists wanted his testimony admitted into the record. This piece of evidence caught Constantine off guard. Just as he was preparing to put the whole matter to bed, the Donatists had re-engaged the channels of imperial rule to draw him back in. The question now needed to be answered. Was Felix of Apthugni really a traditor? Constantine ordered the Vicar of Africa to conduct a formal investigation. The case dragged on until February the following year. The tenure of the original vicar ended, and his successor was soon taken ill. The case therefore fell to the current proconsul of Africa. During the hearing, everything came out. Alpheus Caecilianus himself testified that the final part of his letter, which incriminated Felix of Apthugni, was not authentic, and that he had been effectively deceived by Ingentius into writing the letter itself in the first place, under false pretenses. Under threat of torture, Ingentius confessed to doctoring the text. The governor declared Bishop Felix innocent and had Ingentius imprisoned. In the meantime, while the proconsul was conducting the investigation, the Donatist detainees had been petitioning the emperor to allow them to return to Africa. The emperor eventually permitted them to do so on April 28, 315, and he sent a letter to his praetorian prefects instructing them to have the Donatists use the imperial posts to return home. However, only a few days later, Constantine received the judicial report of the proconsul exonerating Felix of Apthugni, and therefore Caecilian. The emperor immediately canceled the travel permissions he had just granted the Donatists and demanded that they come to court. If they could substantiate even a single charge against Caecilian, the Augustus would consider it as if they had won the entire case. Constantine also ordered Ingentius brought from Carthage to court so the Donatists could hear from his own lips how the charge against Felix was based on forgery. The sequence of events which happened next is not entirely certain. In the early summer, Donatus himself requested permission to return home, but was refused. His supporters, however, caught the ear of an important imperial courtier, Philumenus. Remember him, because he will be important later. Philumenus decided to send a mission of two bishops to Carthage, Olympius and Eunomius, who agreed to consecrate a new bishop for the city. Philumenus, meanwhile, detained both Donatus and Caecilian in Italy. The Donatists down in Carthage, though, refused to commune with Olympius and Eunomius, sparking riots against them in the city. After just 40 days, the episcopal mission shared fellowship with Caecilian's clergy and then promptly left Africa. Later that summer, Constantine journeyed to Rome for a second imperial visit. The occasion was the celebration of his Decennalia, which included the Senate's formal dedication to the emperor of his famous victory arch. While staying in the city, word reached Constantine of the riots the Donatists had instigated in Carthage. The emperor ordered Caecilian, Ingentius, and the Donatist envoys in Italy to be brought before him. Ingentius would confess his crime Killian would be exonerated, and the Donatists would be given the opportunity to be reconciled to the true Bishop of Carthage. However, at this critical moment, much to the embarrassment of the Catholics, Cacilian himself failed to appear. Thus, a final hearing was delayed, which allowed some of the Donatist envoys to escape back to Africa, including Donatus Magnus himself. Constantine at last heard the case in Milan in October of 315. The Donatists finally received the imperial judgment they had petitioned for. As had been the case with all their other appeals, though, the Donatists lost again. Constantine decided in favor of Cacilian. The Catholic Bishop of Carthage returned home, where his rival had already taken up residence. The rest of the Donatist envoys in Italy were finally also allowed to return home, after a year and a half in Europe. Rioting and unrest in the African capital followed, especially after a certain Donatist named Menelaus instigated a serious amount of violence. The Vicar of Africa informed the emperor of the situation. Constantine was out of patience. He had granted every petition the Donatists had shoved in front of him. Two church councils had pronounced on the matter. The accusation of traditio against Felix of Abthugni had been disproven. The secular hearing the Donatists requested had been granted. Now the schismatics were instigating violence. The entire affair had brought shame and indignity upon the Christian name, a name to which the emperor had attached himself. Most importantly of all, the Donatist schism threatened the worship of the supreme god, the god to whom Constantine had entrusted the prosperity of his empire and the security of his person. In his response to the vicar, the emperor stated he himself would come to Africa and conduct an investigation. He would personally settle the matter and demonstrate to all the proper devotion owed to God. We don't know what Constantine would have done if he had gone to Africa, or even if he really intended to actually appear there. For all we know, this could have been a publicity move meant to cow the Donatists. The emperor soon had much more serious things to deal with. By the autumn of 316, Constantine and his eastern colleague and brother-in-law Licinius had fallen out, and were engaged in open war with each other. We'll get into the details of this first civil war between Constantine and Licinius in a future episode. In short, though, Constantine campaigned in the Balkans until early 317, when he and Licinius signed a peace treaty. However, just because the imperial visit to Africa was cancelled, that did not mean Constantine forgot about the schism. From the emperor's point of view, and the view of the rest of the Western Church, the issue had been decided. Since only the Catholic clergy were legally recognized to possess ownership of the church buildings, and since it was the Cacilianists who were deemed Catholic, this therefore meant that the Donatists who occupied the churches in North Africa were illegally squatting on Catholic property. In November of 316, Constantine issued a law to the Vicar of Africa ordering the logical enforcement of this legal situation. Anyone who's failed to make their mortgage payments knows what's about to happen next. The government comes and the bank forcibly repossesses your house. Except in this context, Roman soldiers come and forcibly confiscate the churches for your ecclesiastical rivals. The emperor ordered the churches be given to the followers of Cacilian and the Donatist leaders exiled. When Constantine had originally expressed his intention to come to Africa, he also expressed his rejection of the Donatists' claim to be the heirs of the martyrs. However, the emperor was about to eat his own words. At first, local bribery was used to enforce the emperor's decree. When this failed, an appeal was made, allegedly by Cacilian himself, to two high-ranking military officers, the Dukes Leontius and the Count Ursatius. On March 12, 317, the officers dispatched a group of soldiers accompanied by a mob to dispossess the Donatists from the churches. Violence ensued, Donatist bishops were killed, and at one particular basilica, a massacre took place. The list of specifically Donatist martyrs never became especially large, and outside of Carthage itself, there appears to have been little persecution at this time. However, these events nevertheless served to reinforce the Donatists' view that they were the true church, the Church of the Martyrs. The Caecilianists and the rest of the so-called Catholics were the Church of the Traditores, who, like their forebears, were now collaborating with the imperial government to attack God's people. It was the children of Israel versus the Canaanites, the house of David versus the kingdom of Jeroboam. The Donatists remembered the violence in Carthage long after the events. When Count Ursatius was later killed in battle against barbarian raiders, they saw it as divine vengeance. In their stronghold of Numidia, however, the Donatists faced an accusation of traditio within their own ranks, and against a particularly important bishop at that. The man in question was Silvanus, bishop of the Numidian capital of Cirta, now renamed Constantine after the emperor. Silvanus, you'll recall from the previous episode, was the subdeacon who had been made bishop following the end of persecution. He was denounced to the authorities by his former deacon, Nundinarius. The two men had had a falling out, with Silvanus even going so far as to stone the deacon, though not to death. Nundinarius got his revenge by appealing to the governor of Numidia. At the trial, all of Silvanus's dirty secrets came out. His violent activities with the infamous Purpurius of Lamata, his scandalous acclamation as bishop by gladiators and prostitutes, his accepting of bribes and embezzlement, and, of course, his act of traditio during the Great Persecution. However, even though the governor convicted Silvanus and exiled him, the Donatists continued to support the bishop, believing him to be a confessor. So polarized were the Numidian Christians that not even this scandal dented their convictions. On May 5, 321, after 4 years of imperially sanctioned suppression, Constantine relented. He had strayed from the policy of non-coercion laid out at Milan back in 313. Though Constantine certainly didn't implement anything even remotely close to what the Tetrarchs had done, Donatists had been killed by imperial officials who were technically enforcing his decree. The lessons of the Great Persecution were not lost on him, and Constantine issued a law to the Vicar of Africa, ordering an immediate end to all coercion against the Donatists, and directing those exiled to be returned. Constantine also issued a letter to the Catholics of North Africa, justifying the change in policy. Echoing the Apostle Paul's quotation of Deuteronomy in Romans 12, "Vengeance," the emperor declared, "would be left to God alone." If any Catholics suffered violent reprisals from the Donatists, they would surely be counted by God as martyrs. Constantine's change in attitude was also prompted by political concerns. A second civil war with Licinius was on the horizon. As we'll explore in more detail in the future, the Eastern Emperor had turned against his Christian subjects. In response, Constantine portrayed their final conflict as a holy war of liberation, and presented himself as a divinely chosen deliverer of the Eastern Christians from tyranny and persecution. As such, he could not afford to appear to be a persecutor himself, even towards schismatics. The Donatists now reign supreme in North Africa. Outside the African provinces, their sect was virtually non-existent, save for a small beachhead they had established in Rome. But within Africa, Mauritania, and especially Numidia, they were firmly in the majority. Their strength was so great that they could even deny imperial benefits to the Catholics, such as when they forced their rivals to serve in the local city councils, and forcibly possessed the church buildings. In early 330, Silvanus of Cirta and his followers seized a newly built basilica which the emperor had funded. When the Catholics appealed to Constantine, who was now, spoiler alert, sole emperor, the response was one of pathetic resignation. Constantine simply instructed them to use his rescript to petition the provincial magistrates for public funds to build a new basilica. Though now he had no rivals, the emperor stuck to his policy of non-coercion in Africa. With that, we'll leave the Donatists here for now, triumphant and dominant in their homeland. Thank you for listening. If you have questions or feedback about the podcast, you can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com. Please don't forget to rate and review the show on whatever podcast platform you use. Be sure to visit the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast. And don't forget to visit the website at historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.